Well, even in this age of online communication and cybernetics and all that stuff, there's still people who creatively put words on paper. Of course, those words usually end up online as well. And despite the ever more abbreviated prose required by things like tweets and texts and all that, nothing really beats a crackling good sentence, paragraph or page. Well, since the Tallahassee Writers Workshop and Conference is coming up this weekend, we thought it might be kind of nice to celebrate some notable writers on this week's Perspectives. And I'll preface this by emphasizing our guests are not only wonderful in their own right, but are also stand-ins for the many, many marvelous authors in our area who are not in the studio today. There's just no way we could fit them all in. This is a pretty small space. You get more than four people in here, and elbows are getting into eyeballs and all that kind of thing. So it gets a little uncomfortable. So we hope that some of the writers that we're talking about here who are not here are listening and can join the conversation in the course of the next 50 minutes or so. By the way, I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for joining us on Perspectives this morning. In the studio with us, we say hi to Donna Meredith, novelist and freelance journalist, along with an officer of the Tallahassee Writers Association. Her works include The Glass Madonna and The Color of Lies, and you also helped us out with Pledge Breaks here recently. Thanks, Donna.
I did. It was my pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you on today. Right next door, we welcome Rhett Devane, Southern fiction author, sometimes called the female Carl Hiaasen of Chattahoochee. Among her many works, Evenings on Dark Island, Mama's Comfort Food, and her brand new work, Cathead Crazy, which was released this week. That was quite a party from what I understand. Right?
We had a wonderful time at the Mockingbird Cafe. Great food, had a little biscuit bar to celebrate the Southern biscuit tradition, and just had a great time. Big crowd. Loved it.
Biscuits and Bacardi. Boy, that sounds like a combo.
It was a great combination. Nobody seemed to complain.
Okay. Well, I hope that one goes as well as the previous works that you put out here. Oh, by the way, we're happy to have a rising young writer with us today. She is Grace Jackson, who is just wrapping up her fifth grade year at Tallahassee's Cornerstone Learning Academy. A published poet, powerfully delivered one of her poems at the Florida Capitol this past December during a rally in defense of the environment that just rocked the house. And we also hear you're pretty good at cross-country running, too. Is that true, Grace?
Humbly, I say yes.
What was the latest event you were involved with for cross country?
I think it was the Op Rattlesnake Rodeo race that I ran. It was a 5K.
How'd you do?
It was very tiring. I was sore for several days afterward, but I was kind of pretty happy with my performance.
Yeah, how did you come in?
I'm not sure.
We'll go back and check the archives there and find out. It's good to have you, Grace. Thanks so much for coming in. And we are also honored to have a New York Times best-selling author on the phone with us this morning. He's Steve Berry, the celebrated author of the Cotton Malone fiction series, along with many standalone works, including The Admiral's Mark and his latest, The Columbus Affair, which is out nationally the 15th of this month. He's also the keynote speaker for this weekend's Tallahassee Writers Association conference that runs tomorrow through Sunday. And Mr. Berry, it is a delight to have you on Perspectives today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Great to be here.
As long as we got you on the phone, how did you get into this whole writing biz, since I understand you have also had some other things in your life, such as politics and legal stuff and all of that? How'd you get into writing?
I was a lawyer. I practiced law for 30 years, and 20 years ago, I finally started listening to that little voice in my head, that little voice that every writer has that compels them to write, and I ignored it for 10 years, but then I finally listened to it, and I started writing novels, but unfortunately, it took me 12 years from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word, and I wrote 8 manuscripts, 5 were submitted to New York houses, they were rejected 85 times, so I had a very long process before I was finally bought and published in 2003, and now I'm on my 11th novel, and I get to do it for a living now. So it's been quite an interesting ride for me.
Well, since that first work came out and you actually got that initial acceptance, you have sold millions upon millions of books. Did you ever think it would get like this?
Well, you kind of hope it would, and because I wanted to be a commercial fiction writer. So you it's like a golfer trying to make a putt. You know, you line it up, you give it your best shot, and you're certainly hoping it goes in the hole, but most times it doesn't. And so the same with that. You know, very few writers get to do it for a living. I mean, you can count on two hands, really, the numbers who can really make a living at it nowadays. And I was just lucky. I caught some breaks along the way, and I got to do it. So, I pinch myself. I tell all the time, only in America could that be possible.
Well, it's going to be really great to have you in Tallahassee for the Tallahassee Writers Association Conference this weekend. And Donna Meredith, since this was kind of your shtick here and you have gotten everything together for the conference, how'd you snag this guy?
Well, wasn't that lucky? We try to bring in somebody that has had a lot of success as a writer every year and just got brave enough to call up Steve Barry and ask if he'd come, and being the great guy that he is, he said yes. So we're just delighted that we're going to have him as the keynote, and he's even going to deliver a session on writing international thrillers and how to create that kind of pacing that keeps people turning the pages.
You've got some other things coming up at the conference. Just give us a little synopsis of what's going to be going on.
We've got a lot of things. Few things are open to the public and free. And the first one is Friday evening. Mark Mushton, our local author, who has also made it pretty big with his first book, The Gendarme. Mark is going to be our kickoff speaker. And then Sunday afternoon is free to the public as well. Juliana Baggett is going to be the headliner for the book festival starting at 1:30. And she'll be followed by a lot of local authors, including myself and Rhett. And everybody will be talking for about 10 minutes after Juliana, 10 minutes each. There will also be a lot of sessions that are part of the paid conference for writers. Three college professors, David Matthew Barnes from Griffin, Georgia, Philip F. Deaver from Rollins College, and Pat McInaulty from Johnson & Wales University in Charlotte. They're all coming to present sessions, and it's a great opportunity to learn from a lot of different writers in their area of expertise, like Phil Deaver's is poetry and short stories. Pat McInaulty is going to concentrate on memoir. And David Matthew Barnes does a little bit of everything. He's done 30 stage plays, performed in 3 languages in 8 countries. How many people can say that? And he's also done young adult and adult novels. So we're just really lucky to have put together such a wide variety of writers.
Well, we want to let folks know that you also still have some openings if folks would like to participate in the conference as well. So just in case they want to make a note here, how do they do that?
If you go to our website, twa.org, twaonline.org, it's $140 for TWA members and $175 for non-members. You can still sign up. We can probably handle a few last-minute people who show up at the door, but it would be best if you would go online and sign up first. We have other people who are talking as well, Doug Alderson and Barbara Jo Williams, who are both local authors, nature writer, and self-published. So there's just all kinds of different things that we're going to offer over the weekend. And a New York agent. Now, that's always something
wow.
exciting, too. Nicole Resiniti is coming in, and she's going to be offering critiques and also listen to pitches from authors who would like to try to go the route that Steve did and get in with the big time and take our chances to get published outside the local community.
Well, if we want to see some things that are going on inside the local community and kind of captures the spirit of North Florida and South Georgia better than just about anyone I can think of, that's got to be you, Rhett Devane. Cathead crazy, but really has nothing to do or very little to do with actual cats, right?
Absolutely. Cathead crazy is based on my experiences caretaking my mother in the last 5 years of her life. And that's pretty much the way I felt a lot of the times. I think most caretakers do. You love that person to death, but there are truly times you go cathead crazy. You could get in the car and just drive and not stop until you end up in California. And it's actually based on the term cathead biscuit, which if you are from this area or from the South, you might have heard that. Those are the old-fashioned biscuits made with lard that are big as a cat's head. So thus the cathead crazy thing.
Okay. That just came out this week. So
yes.
How have your books been doing? Because they are so endemic to this whole area. They capture that whole Spanish moss and grits and gravy and that kind of thing. It is so Southern, it's unreal.
Well, so far I've really heard from a number of people across the country. That's the beauty of selling on Amazon.com and online. I've had fans from as far away as Alaska. I've heard from people up north, out on the other coast, little pods of people who are buying the books. And of course, we all look that we would eventually love to go in with the big New York presses. I think anybody who writes has that as kind of an ideal. But because of online vendors, I've really been quite pleased at how they've gone over with people. And I'm getting wonderful responses from folks because they do understand the idea of small town. And that's a very universal type of theme. It's not just Southern. They really get the feel of the characters and what it takes, what it feels like to be in a small town.
Ms. Grace Jackson, you have been doing poetry now for how many years? And how did you get started?
I think I started in first grade. I was unable to read my own poetry. I was into hieroglyphics at the time. My handwriting was not very legible, but I wrote the poetry. And I think I had a poetry class at that time and another one in third grade, and I've just written it because I like to write it. It makes me feel very powerful to have, to read the poetry and everybody will turn around and look at you and it's like you own the moment, you own the universe, and everybody's like, what next?
No, I noticed that back in December when you were down at the state capitol, and that's when we first met. And it was an environmental rally, and we had local representative Michelle Ray Winkle-Vasalinda and Leakey Moncrief from Environment Florida, a whole bunch of folks, and they're out rah-rah for the environment. And then you were introduced, and you read a poem that had exactly what that impact that you're talking about. Everything came to a halt, and it was just you and the traffic that was buzzing by on Monroe Street. That's all you could hear in front of the Capitol. So your words have that effect on people, even grown-up people. We want to talk some more, and we invite your calls and comments, too, at 414-1234, 800-926-8809. And again, if you like writing, that's what we're talking about today, you can go to perspectives@wfsu.org and post your comment there. We'll be right back. We got some super scribes here on Perspectives this morning, members of the local literary community, authors of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and also a New York Times bestselling author on the phone. Boy, you can't beat that. Speaking of phone, Gail is hanging out on the phone, and she has a question for, I believe, Mr. Barry and also Meredith. Hi, Gail.
Tom, it's Gail Swedmark Hughes. How are you?
I tell you, talk about an author here. We were just mentioning you when your name popped up on the screen here, Gail.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Barry's books are upstairs at our house, downstairs, and some of them are on the stairway, thanks to my husband. But, you know, I love his writing, and I love Meredith's writing, and I remember Barry and Fernandina saying that his writing group, I think he had it in Jacksonville, was fairly early in his career. And I remember Meredith saying her writing group helped her create the title. Would one of you please talk a little bit about the function of your writing group? I'm trying to start one, and what are you looking for in that?
And Steve, why don't you take it?
Well, a writing group was vital for me because that's where I learned to teach myself the craft of writing. I learned that from the group, going there and listening. You know, and the thing about a writing group is you got to get the right mix, the right personality, because you realize, you know, 75% of what you hear in a writer's group is pure garbage that you never want to remember ever in your whole life. But 25% of what you hear in that group is absolute gold. I mean, it's just pure gold that you're going to want to remember your entire life. And the question is, how do you know the difference? The difference is you learn the difference from time. From going to the group over a period of time, you begin to learn the difference. And then I was very fortunate. I had a great group, and you've got to find that mix. You know, we had a small group. It was only four of us. We never took it personal. You keep your mouth shut and your ears open. One rule that you always adhere to in a good writer's group is you never, ever discuss story. It's not about story. It doesn't matter whether I like your story or not. What it's about, it's about the craft of writing. It's about the craft and how it's put together. Now, we would talk story maybe afterwards together. I'd get some opinions one way or the other. But in the group itself, you concentrate on craft, on the craft of writing, and everybody has to participate and everybody has to do it. And if you find that right mix, it's absolutely magical, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my writer's group.
Okay. Donna, anything to add?
Oh, absolutely. Everything you said is true. I've been with a couple different ones. Right now, my Wild Women Writers Group is Rhett, Peggy Cassis, and Susan Womble, who will be back with us soon. You can't write isolated in a room. You have to get readers, and your writers group are your first readers. They're the ones who tell you what's wrong with your craft. And then I like to get ordinary readers, people that aren't writers, to read what I wrote. They tell me different things. They get more into the story part of it, I think. So both kinds of readers are important, but it all has to start with the writer's group.
Let me throw this over to you, Rhett. What's the connection between content and format, if you will? You can have a great story and tell it in a really kind of lackluster way, and it doesn't suck anyone in. You can have a not-so-great story, but it's written in such a wonderfully propulsive and engaging way that you just can't put the darn thing down. Do you have to balance that stuff out, or do you give more credence to one side than the other, or what?
I absolutely think it's a balance, because pacing is extremely important. You have to really strike a balance between the narrative and the story and the dialogue and the action. And if you get too much of any one thing, it really, really takes away from the story itself. And the thing that I've learned in the writer's group is to look at my writing. Now I'm going back to novels I wrote several years ago before the group, and totally restructuring them and really looking at how I'm telling the story. You need to tell the story through the character's dialogue, through the action, and not so much that you're just sitting down and telling someone the story. You want them to actually crawl into the story, experience the sense of the story, all of the different emotions that the characters would go through. And that's what the writer's group has really done for me, because now I can go through my own work and see huge flaws and work on them accordingly. And I feel like I've really come a long way because of them.
Okay. Grace, where do you get the idea for your poems? Is it just something that pops into your head?
Yes.
Or you read something, or what?
Yes. So usually it's just I suddenly have out of the blue inspiration that I can't explain. I just suddenly write a poem and it's like, bam, there it is. Other times, less commonly, I see something or am in a situation that inspires me to write a poem about it, but that's kind of rare.
Now, do you run it by, like, any of your classmates at Cornerstone or your family or anything before you kind of go public with it, or what?
Well, they're basically the only ones who hear my poetry, but yes, my family hears a lot of my poetry. My friends don't really read or hear my poetry, except for the poetry I write in class, but that's basically.
Yeah, so you're kind of going for the larger audience then, because other fifth graders, even if they're really good friends, might be, oh, that's just another one of Grace's poems.
Not so much that. It just, I don't usually feel inspired or have a sudden inspiration in the middle of the school day, so I'm less likely to write it there where my friends are. So.
Okay. I heard the dining room table's kind of your base of operation a lot of times. Huh?
Yes.
Okay. Steve Berry, if I could ask you, since you have such a fascinating mix of real, honest-to-gosh history and fiction all going on at the same time and weaving in together, Where do your ideas come from? You'll be reading something maybe about the Knights Templar or the fact that there was some controversy about the origin of Christopher Columbus, and then you're kind of off like a shot, or how does that work for you?
No, I agree with what Grace just said. They kind of come out of nowhere. You don't really know when they will hit. I was walking through the Kremlin and taking a tour, and something the guide said gave me an idea for the Romanov prophecy. You know, I was shown a book one night at an event by someone, and it gave me the idea for the Alexandria Link. The Jefferson Key came from law school when I noticed a clause in the Constitution years ago that did. You just never know where they come from. They one thing that is clear is they don't come when you want them to. They come when you least expect them. And it's a writer's job to recognize them and grab them as quick as you can and hopefully, you know, make something out of them. It's getting harder to find them, I will say, because the fields that I plow in my genre have been plowed a lot. And finding these new and fresh things are very difficult because the last thing the world a writer wants to do is copy someone else. You don't want to do that at all. You always want to put something fresh and different. But luckily, I've got this year's, next year's, and the year after, so I'm okay till 2014.
It always helps to write ahead. But what I'm hearing is there is such a thing as a muse. This is not a mythical beast. Suddenly, just this creative spark, and bang, you have an idea, and you just run with it, don't it?
No, there's a muse. There's a question. There is that thing there. And, of course, we have people who are muses. For me, Elizabeth is my muse. She kind of keeps things going on a steady base, and everyone has someone like that.
Okay. Donna?
I would agree that those first ideas come from just maybe out of the blue. Where the real writing for me comes is in the second draft. The first draft is just get it down onto paper. And I don't know where those ideas come from. I just go with it week after week. And sometimes I'll work 12 hours a day during that first creative phase. The later phases are something entirely different. And that's when the craft and the revision comes in. It's when I find out what I'm really writing about. Sometimes I don't know in the first draft. I don't see all the connections between what I'm doing with the plot and all the subplots. With The Color of Lies, I don't think I realized I was writing about control and a person's need to have control and realizing that you can't control everything in your life. You can control some things. And especially when it comes to other people, there's not a whole lot of control that you necessarily have. In that story, my protagonist is a teacher, and she's concerned about having control over her classroom. But she's also trying to control her father, who's an alcoholic. And in that case, there's not a whole lot she can do, and that's something she has to learn.
Okay, and Rhett, do you get into that too, where the story, you start off at a certain place, but then the story reveals itself, even to you? You didn't plan it. It just kind of happens.
My muses are very much into the weather conditions. I always kid that they pack up in the summer and head to Canada. So I really just edit during the summer on something I've already written, and they check in usually about the second week of October with some new idea, and then I just do my best to keep up with them. It comes out in one big blech, and then I go back and edit whenever they head back up north for the cooler weather. They don't like the heat. They're not southern muses. Even though I do write about the South, they tend to go somewhere it's cool.
Okay, so they're sort of like Canadian snowbirds then, huh?
A little, yes.
Okay. Yeah. We just got an email here that really we should all kind of give some acknowledgement to. The recent passing of Dr. Ann Rudlow. We all know her and her husband and all the great work that they've done down on the coast with the with the research and all that. In fact, Anne, who had just succumbed after a long struggle with cancer, had an op-ed piece out, I think, just about a week and a half ago that was
incredible. I remember reading
incredible.
It.
So did you know her very well, Donna?
No, I didn't, but I was familiar with her writing. I saw it in the Tallahassee Democrat frequently. And she and her husband both have done wonderful work with marine biology. And I think she achieved something that every writer deep inside would like to do, and that's making a difference in the world. Finding an issue that you care about and finding a way to get that across. What Grace was talking about with the power of the pen, the power of words, and they do have the power to shape other people's thinking, open their eyes to something they hadn't thought about before. And I think all writers deep inside hope to achieve that with their writing.
You know, you have this loss of the environment. Grace, that was your poem that you read at the Capitol so powerfully that dealt with something slipping away, something very precious that we have. And if we don't really take care of it, I mean, it's almost like a baby bird you find on the ground. And if you squeeze it too tightly or you don't feed it or nurture it, you know, something horrible is going to happen to it. And that was kind of what you were trying to say in your poem, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of agree with that, and how much we kind of, like, I don't know, take for granted our wonderful little habitat we have here, so, yeah.
Yeah, and that was done so well. Yeah, and Rhett, your habitat, though, the small town, do we feel that slipping away, that there
Absolutely.
Are too few Chattahoochees left in this world?
Yes, and Chattahoochee was such a delightful place to grow up. Of course, we had the mental institution added in, which added a whole other layer of people, and you learn to be very open-minded about people's differences. And, of course, I told the people over in the Hooch I would give them a shout-out. So this is the official Hooch shout-out. I think the small town type of thing, people look back very wistfully at maybe some of their upbringings. It's sad to me that I see so much of especially Florida kind of homogenized now. We're losing a little bit of our southernness, trying to sound a little bit like everywhere else, starting to look a little bit like everywhere else. And I think that's what I really want to preserve, is just the idea that we can speak a little differently and it's okay, and we can act a little differently and that's okay too. And we can eat biscuits that are big as a cat head.
Steve Berry, you take a different approach in your works, in that the reader is whipsawed literally across the world. The most recent work you have that's coming on the 15th, the Columbus Affair. We're in Jamaica. We're in Prague. We're just all over the place, and yet you bring a real sense of authority to all of those locations so that I feel as a reader that I am right there, no matter how improbable this whole thing may be and how many hundreds of years ago it might. How do you get that whole credibility of place into your work?
Well, thank goodness God made National Geographic. So he made that. So you have that available with all the lovely, wonderful pictures that are in there. That is great. But, of course, I in that particular book, I went to Prague and I went to Jamaica. So I was in both of those locales and got to experience those. I do a lot of research. I use 300 to 400 sources per novel. And I was not finding what I was looking for in the books. I just couldn't find it. So finally, Elizabeth and I went to Prague, and then we went to Jamaica. And I found what I was looking for on the ground there. I had to go and dig it. And that sounds like it's romantically wonderful and a lot of fun, but those trips are nerve-wracking and just really a lot of stress, because we're on the ground about 4 to 5 days. We're very intense. We're looking for stuff. We've got to find it. We don't know if it's even there. And luckily, though, we did find both, because there's actually a connection between Prague and Jamaica that involves Christopher Columbus, and it's a pretty cool connection.
And how much of that, though, because I can't tell in many instances where the fiction leaves off and the historical fact begins. You interweave them so well there. Where is the line?
Well, that's why I put the writer's note in the back. Now, that's one reason I put it back there. I keep it accurate to about 90%, 95%, because the closer I can keep it to reality, the better the reader likes it. But I'm writing a novel that's designed to entertain, so I've got to trip it up a little bit. And so that's why I put the writer's note in the back, so that the reader will know, you know, it's not fair for me to write that and not tell you what's real and what's not, because a lot of people are getting their history from novels like mine, which is not necessarily the best thing in the world, because I'm not a historian, I'm a novelist. But I am a person who's read about 400 books on that subject, so I try to give them enough information to lead them on into other investigations.
Yeah, and I noticed that there is a precious little, shall we call it, jumping the shark, where you read something in this genre where, oh, this is so improbable, it could never, ever, ever happen. You always have that little, it could happen. This sounds like it's real.
That's the idea. Usually what happens when you read my writer's note is you think something is false. You're convinced it's false. And when you read the writer's note, you go, oh, my gosh, that is actually real. That's the reaction I want more than anything.
Okay. And Donna, what's the line for you when it comes to fiction versus nonfiction? How much of that is woven together?
I think every writer draws from real life, even if they're writing fiction. And I certainly did with both my novels. And yet they're both very much fiction. The first one, I had to do a lot of research on glass. Glass Madonna required a whole lot of research because I didn't really know anything about it, although my great-grandfather started a glass factory in Clarksburg, West Virginia, where I grew up. I researched it partly by going to a glass studio here in town with Leslie Nolan, who's a very talented glass artist, and I also did a whole lot of online research with that one through museums, and I found all kinds of documents about what it was like to live in Pittsburgh back at the early 1900s. That was very important to parts of that book, and obviously that was all fiction, made-up stuff. But the setting of Clarksburg is certainly drawn from my growing up years in that book. And with The Color of Lies, since it was about teaching and I was a teacher for 29 years, certainly that teaching experience informed what I wrote about. None of the students are actual real people. I wouldn't do that to any of my former students. But I certainly had those kids who were shy, and I worked them into the story.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with our Writers' Roundtable on Perspectives. We have a Writers' Roundtable going on Perspectives this morning. That's in connection to the upcoming Tallahassee Writers Association Conference that is going on starting tomorrow, then going through Sunday. So we have Donna Meredith from the Writers Association here with us, Rhett Devane, who does some terrific, shall we call, atmospheric works.
Yes, I guess that we could call them that. Yeah,
it really, really just captures that Deep South thing. And Grace Jackson is with us, a poet of some incredible note at the Cornerstone Learning Academy. And we also have noted New York Times bestselling author Steve Berry with us to the Columbus Affair, his latest coming out a little bit later on this month. Well, after Columbus Affair, what is next? Steve, you said you had enough material in the can for, the next 4 or 5 years? So what's up next?
I was going to come back next year. He only took a year off this year, and I'm writing that adventure right now. It's going to be set in England. It's called The Tudor Deception, and it's an interesting story dealing with the Tudors, something fascinating I came across about the Tudors a couple of years ago, and Cotton will be there, and then Cotton will return in 2014 with another adventure. So I'll start writing that 2014 book later this year. You stay a year ahead in the book business. You're always 1 year ahead of yourself as far as production goes. Like The Columbus Affair was finished a year ago, so I haven't really thought about that book in a year. I'm getting it back in my brain now so I can get ready for the release that happens on the 15th.
As improbable as some of the situations that Cotton Malone gets into and the bouncing around the planet and all of these incredible adventures, how do you keep him believable so the average person goes, yeah, I can relate to this guy?
Well, that's what I think Cotton's attraction is. He's not a superhero. He's not a James Bond. He's not that kind of guy. He's an ordinary fellow. He's got an ex-wife. He's got a son. He's got a problem with the son. He has to work for a living. He has to, earn a paycheck. He's got employees he has to deal with. But then again, every once in a while, he gets drawn into quite extraordinary adventures because of his former experience working with the Justice Department in the Magellan Billet. So he's kind of an ordinary guy in a lot of ways, but he has extraordinary extraordinary skills in certain situations. And that's what the readers really have identified with, and kind of they really like that about him. He makes mistakes. He screws up. He underestimates. He's terrible with women. He just has all kinds of everyday problems that we can all relate to.
Yeah, but he also has those incredible MacGyver moments where you think, how the heck did he pull that off?
He does. He can rise to the occasion at the extraordinary moment and do some extraordinary things, and that's what makes him a little bit larger than life and gives him that little extra quality that endears him to folks. And when I created him in 06, I had no clue that anyone would like him or care about him, and so I used my personality in him pretty much, because I didn't know what else to do, so I just used me. And I've been very fortunate that he's now been around for 7 adventures.
Well, we can't wait to catch adventure number 8 that is forthcoming. Grace, when we were talking about your poetry and the fact that it just sort of, in most instances, comes, it just boom, and it's there, and you're the conduit. You're just kind of writing this stuff down as someone tells you. Has your muse ever said, maybe let's get away from poetry for a little bit and get into more of a telling a story in more of a prose kind of way? Or?
Yeah, I've written stories. There's a certain story I've written 6 times read to one of my friends, and she's getting pretty tired of it.
Is she like your editor or what?
No, she's just, well, sometimes I guess, but mostly I just like write it so we can laugh about it. And
you have to have a sounding board.
Yeah, and that's just basically the thing. I never picture it having any kind of future with anybody else, but I just like writing stories and poetry, and I just like doing it.
Yeah, do you have any idea that maybe just possibly that's something that you could do not just to enjoy, but maybe even if you could get other folks besides your friend to look at and go, wow, hey, that's pretty neat that you could do something with it, for the rest of your life as far as even making some money?
I think that would be cool, but I don't really imagine that or hope for that. I'm happy to write my poetry and think it's amazing that I can do it and not be, like, ambitious.
Okay, but it's Donna, you've worked with younger writers before. You're a teacher, for crying out loud. So for someone like Grace, where do you go from here? What do you suggest?
Keep writing. It's all about the practice. If you've read Malcolm Gladwell's The Outliers, that tells you need 10,000 hours of practice to get good at something, she's well on her way. But don't do it for money, because writing poetry is never going to bring you any money. You do it because you love to do it, because you have to do it. You have something inside that you want to get down on the paper. And as long as she keeps doing it for that reason, it's wonderful. And maybe someday, who knows, she'll get that lucky break. But I know Steve's lucky break came after a lot of hard work and having a thick enough skin to take those 83 rejections that he talked about. That's a lot of rejection, and it's very hard to keep going when you get turned down that many times.
Yeah, no, Rhett Devane, you've got a lot of books floating around out there. How well have these things been selling?
I've been very fortunate. Of course, I'm not like Mr. Barry. I'm not making a living at it just yet, but of course I have some ambitions that way. Enough to pay for itself, enough to take me to conferences. And it's not really about the money, like Donna said. It's really about the fact that you're just enjoying the heck out of what you're doing. And you're getting feedback from people and hearing from folks that you have no reason to like what you've put out. They're not related to you in any way. So therefore, they give you an honest opinion. And just hearing from someone every now and then saying, well, that made me laugh and that uplifted me. It's worth it. That's what pays for writing. It has nothing to do with the money.
Okay, and Stephen, in your case, since it has become a pretty darn successful way of keeping body and soul together, would you continue to write even after, let's say, it all crashed and burned tomorrow and you fell off of the bestseller lists and suddenly you're kind of back to where you started? Would you keep doing this?
Sure. You write because you have a little voice in your head that tells you to write, and you keep doing it. And you write, you do it, as just was said. People ask all the time, why do you write? You write because you have to. You don't have any choice. A little voice gets you to do it. So, yes, I would keep doing it. I'm fortunate that I get to do it for a living, and that's a good thing in one respect. It's a bad thing in another respect, because you do have to be a little more conscious of the business aspects of writing. The business of writing can begin to dominate a little bit, and you have to be very cautious of that. And I have to deal with it. I spend 2 to 3 hours every day on the business of writing because, unfortunately, in this business, the score is kept in dollar bills, and that's how they keep the score, and that's the only way it's kept. And I can't be oblivious to that reality, and I have to, you know, keep that in mind. But I still write because I want to write and because I have a little voice that tells me to write, not because they give me a paycheck.
As we know, the entire literary arena is changing right now. We see the old line hardcover bookstores, not only individually owned ma and pa operations, but even biggies like the late lamented Borders and others falling by the wayside, moving publications into online formats and all. How do you see that playing out for authors particularly?
Well, it's definitely changing. We live at a moment in time, which is very interesting. We live at the exact moment when we are switching the delivery system of information from paper to ones and zeros on a screen. And we're at that moment in history when that's happening. It's quite exciting. It's the e-revolution. It started in 08. It's been pretty much completed now. The revolution is here, and it's not going away. Now, is the book going away? Absolutely not. The book's not going anywhere. But will it become the primary delivery system of information over the next 50 years? No. It's going to switch to something else, and it's quite exciting to be in that to live at this moment. Right now, in my genre, and me particularly, 70% of my sales are e-book sales. So it's breaking out about 70-30 now. Now, to give you an idea of how that was, 3 years ago, it was 5% of my sales. So that shows you the dramatic shift of the e-revolution. And again, it's something you cannot ignore. It's something you cannot pretend it doesn't exist. It's here. It's happening. And it's going to just do nothing but make things get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
And does that help you, Grace, that you can actually – you can be published. You can go online. You can have, whether it's, you know, a simple Facebook page or your own standalone website, where you could put your poetry, you could archive it, you could ask for reader feedback, all that kind of thing. I mean, you actually have as much clout online as Steve Barry does. Is that scary?
No.
How could you make use of that to bring your work to the attention of more folks beyond, you know, your friends at Cornerstone and your family?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not especially knowledgeable or into the technology. But I think it would be exciting to have more people read my work and
Sounds like something that might be coming up at the conference here, Donna.
Well, probably. There'll be a lot of talk about self-publishing versus traditional publishing, and a lot of talk about e-books and whether they're going to overtake paper. It's an environmentally friendly thing, whereas you're not having a whole lot of overrun that just ends up destroyed, which is what happens with books sometimes. Hard to imagine that someone actually just destroys books, but it does happen. I see young people having an opportunity. A local student talked to me recently with her mother about self-publishing her book. She has 3 novels written. She's a Leon County girl, April Bradley, and she has 3 wonderful stories. I believe they're all in science fantasy of some sort. And she's going to go through the self-publishing route with CreateSpace, which any young person can do now, no upfront fees. So the opportunities there for young writers to break into a field that used to be absolutely closed to anybody without going through a New York agent.
I think all Grace needs is a webmaster, and we're all set to go.
I think that's what she needs.
See, we could scare one up here. Has that changed your approach to writing too, Rhett?
Maybe a little bit. I still really like conventional books because I love the feel of a book. And I think it loses a little in the translation with the cover because so much goes into cover design and the colors. But I can see where e-books, it's an amazing thing. I have a Kindle and I enjoy it. But whenever I am looking towards a book that's produced by one of my friends, I will buy the hard copy, the paperback, because I've yet to be able to figure out how to sign someone's arm or whatever when they have a Kindle. And I love the idea of having a personally signed book. So I think they'll always have a spot. But I really do enjoy both. I guess I could probably go both ways.
Yeah, or you could just learn how to send a virtual signature to someone's Facebook page, I guess. I don't know.
Something.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same feel to it, does it?
Not quite, but you know, we'll work on it. We'll figure that out.
The younger generation is going to be the one that is not so used to holding the paper book in their hands.
Yeah.
For us old timers, you know, we're used to the paper books, and I think we'll always love them.
Well, Steve Berry, in the few moments that we have remaining, could you give us just a quick little synopsis what you're going to be bringing to the table as far as the Tallahassee Writers Association conference this weekend?
Well, I'm hoping when I talk to writers to inspire them, because I'm sort of the living proof poster child that you can do it. I mean, you know, 11 years ago, I couldn't give away a manuscript. I couldn't just say, you can have it free. I'll give it to you. And now I'm in 50 countries around the world. And, you know, it just, I'm sort of like the living proof. Don't tell me you can't do it, because I did it. I did it, started from nothing, absolutely zero. And if you read my first manuscript, see how horrible it truly was. You can see how the craft has progressed. So, and I worked. I had a full-time job, and I was a county commissioner as well. So I want to try to bring that to the table to show them, you know, give some inspiration that you can do it. And I want to keep people moving forward, because the greatest enemy to a writer is the quitting. You know, 99% of all writers never finish what they start, and that's the what I try to combat is the quitting aspect of it to do. And then in the session I'm going to teach, I'll talk a little bit about the tricks and the do's and don'ts about suspense and keeping it moving forward and keeping you know, the reader engaged in the page, because it's our job to keep that reader in that page and never let them up from it. You know, they got to go from page to page, chapter to chapter. So they're going to get a pretty good instruction, and I hope a little inspiration from this weekend.
Boy, that should be exciting. I know what it's like to just stare at a single sheet of paper and know that you have to create enough verbiage to fill it. When you're staring at like 483 empty pages, what that must feel like. Terrible. What else for the conference this weekend, Donna?
Well, the public can come to hear Steve at lunchtime. It's $25 because it includes lunch. And you can get tickets on our website at twaonline.org. You can also buy tickets to the Saturday night dinner. Erica Thaler with COCA will be our speaker. And we would like to thank COCA, the City of Tallahassee, Leon County, and the Leon County Tourism Development Council, who all gave money so that we could bring the community this program. So people should still show up, sign up online. I forgot to mention Jessica Morell is coming from Portland. Famous editor. She's widely published with Writer's Digest, a lot of books that she's written on writing, and she's going to share her expertise. We just are offering so many things. You don't want to miss this one.
And where exactly is this all being held?
The Holiday Inn and Monroe Street Conference Center at I-10 on Graves Road. So come on out. At least show up for the free things if you don't show up for the paid.
And you can rub elbows with some really great writers like Rhett Devane. Any final thoughts, Rhett?
I'd say come hang out with us, because you get to talk about characters and plot lines to people who, unlike your family, don't want to choke you for mentioning them one more time. You be with your friends and you can just talk until you're blue in the face about writing and really enjoy yourself.
And bounce all kinds of neat ideas and try to get that balance between, we don't care about the story, we want to see how you tell it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Grace, what's ahead for you as you head into grade 6 over there at Cornerstone? Going to keep writing, obviously, but any other things coming up in your life that you'd like to share?
Not Not that I can think of. I am learning to ride, but that's not very related.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, there is a lady here in town that I had a chance to meet just a couple months ago. She is very much into that whole horsey thing out, north of town, where all the horse farms and everything are. And she learned from very early age how to draw and paint horses really well. And now she is illustrating books using that talent just because she really, really likes horses. And I wonder what kind of poetry your muse might be able to turn you on to once you really learn that riding thing. Because horses are neat. They have a special intelligence to them that you might bond with.
I am very fond of horses.
Well, we're very fond of you, Grace. Thank you so much for coming on. Rhett Devane, Donna Meredith, and, of course, Steve Berry. Thank you so much for coming on Perspectives and joining us today. Good luck with the Writers' Conference coming up this weekend. Perspectives, produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by the inimitable Taylor Cox. Nicole Knight on the phones and emails today. I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week. More expert opinion and your input, of course, right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.